The Fan on Demand. Winning isn't everything. He wouldn't know. He's never lost. Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports. Now on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Monday, the 22nd of September, 2014. Hey, wait a second. It's autumn.
Feels like it today.
It's supposed to warm up the rest of the week. It's supposed to be
early low 20s. It's going to be very nice.
Low to mid 20s. Supposed to be very nice. Don't put the golf clubs away yet. Not you. You don't have any golf clubs.
Put the fishing rod away. But I never do that.
Well, no, I wouldn't expect you to. There are fish that are still swimming out there that have not been slaughtered yet by you.
That's right.
So if they're out there, beware. Brunt is still around.
I'm going to get this week, for sure.
Well, Carol of the Bleacher Report will join us a little bit later on. But first, here's our friend Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. So Mr. Ryan, the folks at Major League Baseball decided to put together a committee. Mm-hmm. They don't do that very often, but here's a committee that is going to examine, among other things, how do you make the game quicker? So my guess is they're going to wind up doing nothing because this is a game that moves at a snail's pace when it comes to change. And we love it because of that, I guess, the traditional aspect of it. But is there one thing that jumps out at you, something that has driven you crazy for low these many years, that if only baseball would do this, we could get out of the ballpark at a more reasonable time? Is there one?
Oh, do the listeners, do they think that it's possible that this is not a setup question? When I give you the answer, is yes. Oh, my God, yes. This isn't a panacea, but it is the answer to your question, what is driving me crazy. Approximately 25 years ago, perhaps even more recent than that, more batters were ready to bat than fidgety, time-consuming pitchers were ready to pitch. And that was an annoyance, that these pitchers were a problem. Now, that has been almost totally reversed, with the conspicuous exception of a couple of known sluggers, laggards such as Josh Beckett, who might be retiring. The fact is that the growth of the batting ritual has been embedded in baseball, and it must be removed. Now, I'm speaking of the Nomar Gasparis, who's gone, the David Ortiz, who's not gone, the Bernie Williamses, who's gone, but there are plenty of others who have to step out of the box after every pitch and go through their little ritual. And then when and only when they are completely ready and have set themselves, there's the pitcher now allowed to pitch. And you will see that the more pitchers are ready to pitch by a large number than batters are ready to bat. That is something that would certainly help. And you would just govern this very simply. You, number one, effective the 2015 season, minor leaguers would be told no rituals are involved, and you will have to stay in the box once you get in, with two exceptions. You're driven out by a head-hunting pitch, or you foul the ball off yourself. But other than that, you stay in. And you get out. You allow one out maybe per at-bat. And the umpire will signal when things are ready. And if you're not ready, and the pitcher throws anywhere in the ballpark, it's a strike, and that will help. That's one thing. But there are one of the problems that we still would have is the pitch count, pitch taking mania of the count phenomenon, which is the way people are taught to bat these days, would still continue. But do you not agree that has it not been your observation that more pitchers are ready to pitch in large numbers than batters are ready to
bat? Yes, and you would concede too, acknowledge that, the one thing they talk about is putting a clock on pitchers, and really I think you're right. It's about hitters more than it's about pitchers. There are pitchers who are painfully slow out there, but there are far more hitters.
We hear them with the clock being enforced. I often and I know this speaks, you know, you can make of this what you will, but because I am so obsessed with this topic, I very often sit at games, and for a period of time, for an inning or four or five batters, I count the time sequence between the return of the ball from the catcher to the pitcher and the next delivery of the next pitch. And it ranges from as quick as 6 seconds to as long as deep into the 20s. And you add up that deep into the 20s over a period of nine innings, and it does add up.
Well, and we are blessed here in Toronto with seeing Mark Burley pitch every fifth day, who is almost inarguably the quickest pitcher in baseball, given the circumstances. He gets the ball, he's ready to go. He doesn't fool around. But what the hitters do is out of his control, and hitters being allowed to step out whenever they want will do that probably as much or more with Burley as they do with any other pitcher, in an attempt to somehow throw him off his rhythm or whatever, which seems logical, but even with a Burley pitching, it slows the game down.
But Bob, with the work in the count, you know, working the count and working the pitch count tactic, which has, you know, it's been so successful, right, for teams. Teams have kind of made it, it's become one of those, you know, mantras for teams. This is what we do. Yeah. This is our philosophy, and it works, right?
Well, it can be counterproductive, too, because, yes, it seems to work, except that it's an issue with the Mets. I noticed that the writers were harping on the Mets this year and certain people. You always take strike one, and the sudden, next thing you know, if you're habitually in an 0-2 count, it's often because you habitually take strike one, which is a very hittable pitch, when a pitcher is reasonably certain that you're not going to swing. You need to change it up a little bit, maybe, not have a complete procedure that you follow slavishly every single at-bat. But that's not the way anybody thinks right now, but you could change that thinking. I mean, thinking can change. The other thing that's gone on, and I don't know that it's as prevalent now as it was a number of years ago, throws to first because of the fear of running. You know, in the 50s, when baseball was a station-to-station game, and at one point in time, I believe it was 1950 itself, Dominic DiMaggio led the American League in stolen bases with 15. You can look it up, but he did lead the league in stolen bases with 15 somewhere in there. And the stolen base was put back into baseball not by Maury Wills, as is popularly thought, but by Louis Aparicio, who stole 56 bases, I believe, in 56, and that completely revolutionized the game that had fallen into a certain pattern over the previous 30 or 40 years. It was in those days, you can imagine, nobody was throwing to first because nobody was running. And now they throw to first. That's another thing. And, of course, we all know that the number one problem is the commercials that on every game being televised, that it adds,
sure.
What is it, I believe 2 minutes and 20 seconds, is it, guaranteed,
yep.
Between innings. So, but I just think that the number one thing they could easily mandate is elimination of rituals. Starting in the minor leagues next year, nobody gets a ritual. They enforce a clock, and the clock is aimed equally at the batter as the pitcher. They really have never made a firm commitment to a clock, but I think if they do so, they would get some.
I hate the idea of a clock.
Well, but no, wait, let's address this, you see, because this is, I think we're getting to the point here. This is the issue. Baseball is the only game that we play in North America where there is no clock. Nowhere. You can't even find the time of day if you go into a lot of ballparks. But that aside, is it time, even though there's a theoretical clock that exists that umpires really ignore, is it time to put one up on the scoreboard and watch it tick down?
No.
Would that be the worst thing that ever... See, there's Brunt there.
No.
You know, crotchety
yeah.
old Brunt.
You know, you don't have
doesn't
to.
Want
What's
to see
objection?
That. Hmm?
What's your objection?
I think... It is one of the things that distinguishes the game, you know, is that, and I really do.
It distinguishes the game. The one thing that distinguishes the game is simple fact that it's not over until the 27th out's recorded. Yeah. That's the distinguishing factor that separates baseball from the other games. That's where not having a clock is most relevant. But having a clock to speed the game up because people are purposely, are just ridiculously prolonging it for no real good reason that any of us can accept. Other than their own idiosyncrasy, I don't think that in any way. I'm a traditionalist. Good God, I'm the guy you're talking to that scores every game he's gone through since 1977, and I can prove it. Okay, I'm just telling you, I'm a traditionalist, but I don't see any harm to baseball's tradition and its uniqueness by having a clock on the pitchers and the batters for an at bat.
I think you can achieve the same. I just think you can achieve the same thing by not letting guys step out, you know, and maybe limiting the amount of times that, you know, that they can call time.
Well, but, I think one timeout, you know, I mean, we could negotiate that. And also catchers' limits. Some of these catchers are ridiculous now. And some of these catchers spend half their time running the second out to the mound. We know there's a limit already on how many times a pitcher, coach, or manager can make a visit in an inning, but a catcher should be restricted too. And some of these catchers, I mean, all little things would add up to a degree, but nothing more than eliminating rituals and making
them
stay in the box and enforcing.
If you didn't let them step out, Bob, and the pitcher's going to be ready to pitch, you're not going to have guys sitting there adjusting their elbow pads endlessly because they're going to be looking. At a 95 mile an hour fastball going by him, so you know if you just make him stay there, I think that achieves it.
Let's start with that. I think all right. So we're 3 for 3 on that one. That would be my number one recommendation. Beyond that, I don't know what.
I'll tell you something that bugs me, but it doesn't really impact on the game all that much. Any ball that touches the ground goes anywhere. That might have the slightest abrasion upon it, a discoloration of a quarter of an inch, is immediately removed from the game as if it has become the pariah of the sporting event. I play golf. I'll hit golf balls off cart paths, off trees, and keep hitting them until the thing is like an egg-shaped. Do we need to replace all these baseballs? Do we need to throw baseballs out of games if anything should happen to it?
Well, it's true. And not often, but occasionally before the ball's even used, a pitcher will look at a ball and say, no thanks. It's often, but I've seen it, and throw it out and have it asked to be have it thrown out before the umpires almost always acquiesce. They do always acquiesce. I'm not sure that's a big problem.
No, it isn't. It just bugs me.
Baseball, after the lockout after 94, when we resumed play in 95, baseball got on a kick where it's going to be fan friendly, and one of the things it did was completely reverse a policy that existed from beginning of time, which was preserving rather than hoarding as many baseballs as possible. Now everyone throws everything into the stands. Every third base and first base coach, foul ball tosses it in the stands. Okay, I remember with great fondness and humor, a wonderful traveling secretary of the Red Sox named Jack Rogers, who was notorious in our press box back in the 60s and 70s, when a ball would be thrown needlessly into the stands, he would start almost screaming. Jiminy Christmas and something. All he could see was the 250 or the 550 or whatever a baseball cost from his ball club being thrown into the stands. Well, now, of course, they throw 50 baseballs a day into the stands. Anyway, I'm digressing.
Well, you got to charge the players.
All right.
I mean, I think...
That's a big change. But, I mean, I just think we go back to the essential dynamic of baseball, the batter-pitcher confrontation, takes way too long.
Right.
I mean, you time somebody's at-bats. It's just astonishing.
Well...
It really is.
The other thing, and I mean, this is an obvious one. I mean, we have now instituted this instant replay, which I actually am in favor of. I like the instant replay, but the process of instant replay is fundamentally flawed. This whole parade out to, hi, how are you, to the umpire, 30 seconds glance back in the dugout till your bench coach gives you the thumbs up or thumbs down because they've looked at the replay to make an evaluation of whether they should protest the call or not. I mean, this has got to change, does it not?
Well, it's just a year one.
I do get that.
And I would say that this is going to be a subject, I would think, Bob, I really believe, in a great discussion in the offseason, and I think that everyone's aware of this. And they're going to try to put their heads together to figure out a way to streamline it. I give them a pass on year one, and
me too.
I hope that there'd be some improvement in year two.
With Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Okay, and there's nothing else we can think of. Brent, do you have any other suggestions as to how?
I don't know. It's just you can't change managers and players from taking pitches and throwing the first, and I don't know how else you do it. I really don't. I just think this batter-pitcher confrontation can be streamlined significantly.
What if you didn't allow? Let me imagine something. What if you banned throwing to a base?
Mm.
What does the game look like in that scenario?
Mm.
You could step off the mound, but you couldn't throw over there.
Yeah, I don't know. Because we don't know. That's something we don't know. Would Billy Hamilton steal 200 bases? I don't know.
Maybe.
Change anything? I don't know.
I don't know whether that would be bad or not.
I don't. You know, that's something I hadn't considered. But that's sounds radical to me.
It does. It's very radical,
and
I would acknowledge.
I can't imagine. I don't know what the game
You're right.
looks like.
Yeah. Don't. All right. I see the Mets extended Sandy Alderson.
Wow.
Why?
I read the papers in New York faithfully, and I guess Alderson and Terry Collins will survive. But Alderson, his excuse for not producing the way people thought the hallowed Sandy Alderson would, of course, is the Madoff scandal, which has imperiled the finances of the Mets and makes them act as if they are a small market or medium-sized team and don't spend. And
right.
And he has, in fact, developed some young pitchers. And DeGrom is a very good prospect for Rookie of the Year. Wheeler's for real. Harvey will be back next year. They've got a bullpen that was very solid. They might have some pitching anyway, but he gets that's the defense of Sandy Alderson. He's been hamstrung financially and can't make the moves. And he's already announced that their paywall next year is not going to be anyway satisfy their ravenous fans.
Well, their ravenous fans are not showing up.
However many there are.
Yeah, I was going to say, Bob, they've become such an afterthought in that they have a lovely new ballpark they built for themselves, but that place has been empty the second half of the season.
Well, they have lost that. The battle for the hearts and minds of the New York sports fan, and although they always had their own constituency, it was pretty well assumed that they were a product for the most part of Long Island, and which includes Brooklyn, of course, which is the southwestern tip of Long Island. So many people have no idea that that's the geographic landmass where Brooklyn is. It's on Long Island,
right?
And the Yankees are Connecticut, New Jersey, and Westchester, etc. But there was a time in the not all that distant past when the Yankees were down, the Mets were up, and the Mets were drawing $3 million, and the old Shea Stadium was hopping, and that day could come again, I suppose. I would like to think if the Mets really seriously contend in the next couple of years that they'll go back and draw some people.
Which raises a different point in a different sport. But you'll understand that there's a relationship here that kind of popped into my mind when you're talking Mets and Yankees and multiple franchises in the same city. Today, Gary Bettman did a speech at the Canadian Club, and among the things that has been speculated upon for the National Hockey League is the rumor that Bettman was about to expand the NHL, perhaps by as many as 4 teams. Bettman poo-pooed that idea, saying, we may look at expansion again, but not right now. And then went on to say that he's not a fan or in favor of multiple franchises in the same city.
Uh-huh.
Presumably unaware or ignoring the fact that there are a bunch of them in New York. There's a couple of them in Los Angeles. He already has markets where there are multiple franchises and probably could move his Florida and Phoenix franchises to Toronto and Montreal respectively, put second teams in there and never have to worry about the economics of those two franchises for the rest of his life. What do you make of that?
As long as I can remember, people have been suggesting that Hamilton could support a franchise, and that Toronto specifically, however, could support 2 with no trouble. That's as long as I can remember. Right. I don't know where this comes from. I'm very surprised that he would make that declaration. As far as the expansion in general is concerned, is not Seattle knocking on the door, for example? And I certainly concur with your assessment of the franchises you mentioned, and as always, the woebegone Coyotes and. I'm surprised. I don't know where that comes from. That's kind of surprises me. I mean, and Quebec, my God, we know they're ready, tomorrow, next 5 minutes to get back in the league. So, odd. But as far as the dual franchise thing, is he aiming that specifically at Toronto, right? And lumping in.
Well, it would seem.
Pretty much saying, even though Hamilton's a separate market, I understand that. You like to think he understands that. But, I mean, I don't know what this is coming from.
Well, and I can make the argument that a team in Hamilton would be a far greater concern to the folks in Buffalo than a second team in Toronto. Geographically, it's kind of stuck in the middle. And the truth is that there are some folks in the Niagara Peninsula in southern Ontario, south of Lake Ontario. There are many who go to Buffalo Sabres games. Very few of them will come to Toronto Maple Leaf games. So, the notion that Buffalo would suffer by a second team in Toronto is absurd. It's 15, 20 minutes to Buffalo. It's an hour to Toronto. So they aren't going to go around the lake. Hamilton might be a slightly different scenario, but,
but in any event.
The whole thing is puzzling.
And I'm curious to know what his thought process was.
Well, Bettman was supposed to be on with us earlier today, but he bailed. So I don't know. Maybe we'll catch up with him in a little while, and we'll confront him on this very issue. Quickly, in the National Football League, Eagles, Cardinals, Bengals. undefeated.
Mm-hmm.
Any one of those jumps out at you as a shock?
I'm going Cardinals. Although they've lost their defensive people, I shouldn't say that. As soon as I said that, I realize now that they're doing it, and surprisingly, despite having lost Dockett and some other defensive people, I may have to shift to the Bengals. The big question with Andy Dalton, who got the big new raise and a huge new contract, was the fact that though he has regular season numbers, he has not produced in their opportunities in the playoffs. But they seem to be solid. I like the Eagles. I like them. I don't think they're exciting. I don't know. We can start equating them to some lopsided teams of the past in both hockey and basketball. The San Antonio Spurs or pick a hockey team that was a great offensive team and so defensively. But the Eagles they're always going to score points on you, and they're always. I think they're excited. They're a team you want to watch.
Oh yeah,
no doubt. You want to watch the Eagles. Bengals people,
I think they're for real.
Sentiment that the Bengals are very much for real.
Yep.
Now we're going to find out. They're going to have their opportunities against Pittsburgh and in their division, and we'll find out. But there's always somebody. I'll tell you one thing. I will go on record. 49ers aren't going anywhere.
No.
This year, period.
Well, and it's interesting. And the other thing, Bob, a lot of people after Week One were going to concede the NFC to Seattle. They say they're coming back. They can repeat.
My hand was up.
Yeah. But we've now seen that Green Bay's not what a lot of people thought they were going to be. So them being beat up that first week maybe is not that meaningful. But also, even the Super Bowl rematch, they win it yesterday at home, but it's a lot different game than the Super Bowl was.
Yeah, that was good. I thought it was a very good game day for Denver. Didn't get a W, but I think they restored a lot of self esteem with regard to how they played on the road in that place and that comeback and all. Yeah, that was a. I don't think they go out of there saying, we can't beat these guys. I think they totally believe they can beat these guys on a neutral field, and that's the only place they'll see them again would be on that neutral field. So, I think there's a lot of uncertainty that you're right. The first week, I said, oh, my God, look at that. And the Percy Harvin looked like they were going to score at will. They're still good. I'll tell you what, Russell Wilson, I am – count me in. I'm going to send a check to the fan club after watching that performance.
Well, that drive in overtime was pretty special.
And the thing that people – he never – the way he handles himself when he takes off, he knows how to get down. And he protects himself. He's really good. He's really, really good. I admire him.
Mr. Ryan, we'll talk to you again next week. Thank you as always.
Okay, terrific. Bye-bye.
Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Injuries have hit the National Football League in a big way. But the interesting thing is it's not about concussions to a great extent. It's other things that are going on.
Some lot of gruesome things. There's been some nasty, nasty injuries that are not head injuries this year.
Will Carroll of the Bleacher Report joins us. Will, how are you?
I'm doing great. I don't have a concussion today, so I'm good.
Excellent. Robert Griffin, Jamal Charles, D'Angelo Hall, all going down with ankle and leg injuries. Just one of those things, or is there something else going on here now?
Well, certainly we have to take a look at it and say, is there any sort of pattern here? And with Robert Griffin, we just have to completely take him out of pattern. We've never had an injury like this. It wasn't an ankle dislocation like what it looked like, but actually it's a subtalar dislocation. That's the bone in the foot one level down from what we normally call the ankle. We don't have any of these. For the three injuries he's had, the two ACLs, and this new dislocation, all of them are freak injuries. Nobody says, you have weak ligaments. It's the fact that you get hit in just the wrong way, or in some cases you move the wrong way, and you see things like the crazy Stephen Tulloch injury where the ACL just gives.
Yeah.
Now Griffin,
traumatic injuries like that, you take them out of the pattern. You can't prevent those. Those are those that really are part of the game or just bad luck. When you take a look at a high ankle sprain like what Jamal Charles has, with D'Angelo Hall, you have Achilles tendon ruptures, and we've had several of those this year. You take a look at the broken leg and ankle for Danny Woodhead, then you do have to worry about it. But I think the one that's the most disturbing to me is Matt Cassel. That was the classic Lisfranc injury. Yeah, doctors today online were talking about, we need to get this picture of his foot breaking and put it in textbooks because this literally is the textbook example of what causes a Lisfranc fracture. And it was so clearly caused by the turf. As much as the turf has advanced, we've seen more and more of these type of Lisfranc fractures. We've seen more and more high ankle sprains. And I think it comes down to have we advanced the sport too much? Is the stickiness of the combination of turf, including grass, I'm not just knocking artificial turf here, but the shoes. The shoes have gotten to the point where there's almost nothing to them except friction. There's no protection. A guy gets stepped on. There's no support for a situation like what Castle found himself in. We've seen Julio Jones. We've seen Ahmad Bradshaw. These guys breaking down because there's just far too many forces on the foot for it to hold up. The game is too fast at this stage for the human body, and that's pretty scary.
Well, I'm of an age when I can certainly remember that virtually every lineman in the National Football League wore high-top shoes, and a whole bunch of others wore high-top shoes. If I'm not mistaken, Johnny Unitas as a quarterback wore high-tops for a good portion of his career, and there were a bunch of others. You know, it's like, do you want to go back to your Converse shoes? You know, those high-tops, you know, did they really... If you wore those running around the playground, did they really support your ankle? I don't think so. But these ankle problems and foot problems be solved by different footwear, do you think?
No, we've advanced it. But the fact is, when you take a look at, you know, the Converse that Larry Bird wore and the Nikes that they're going to build for LeBron James this upcoming year, it's like, you know, the difference between the car you drove in high school and the car you drive now. You know, I drove a Fiero that most of the time the engine didn't catch fire, but it didn't have airbags. It didn't have seat belts, for God's sakes, but that, you know, Pontiac tried. And today I've got a car that I think has 12 airbags, more computers than the Apollo program. So there's lots of advances, whether it's cars or shoes. I think what we've come to notice is that there's two things. First off, the ankle support isn't needed because all these guys are either wearing ankle braces underneath or they're getting taped up.
Okay.
So I don't think that's
they are taped,
an issue,
sure.
And I wouldn't say that. It's the question of the friction and the lightness, the lack of support. We've given up all sorts of support in terms of lightness. And there's science behind this. If you have lighter shoes, you don't have to move as much. David Epstein wrote a great book called The Sports Gene that talks about how much more force you can generate if your legs are smaller, which is why certain genotypes that come from East Africa actually have advantages when it comes to building sprinters and middle distance runners. And the same is true. Take a look at Colin Kaepernick. The guy is, his legs look tiny. I mean, he's strong and he's certainly fast. But if you added, you know, shoes that have just a couple more ounces to him, would he be as fast? No. Same thing with linemen. You know, linemen now are quick. They're not sprinters by any stretch of the imagination, but we've got guys running sub 5:40s. When you watch, there was a play a couple weeks ago that I saw where Jason Kelce, who's now out with his own hernia, was lead blocking on a screen, and he was out in front of Darren Sproles. And Darren Sproles wasn't really catching up with him that much. That's outlandish to think of 20 years ago,
right,
when the difference between a wide receiver and a lineman would have been, you know, measured by the calendar.
But you're right about some of these guys having kind of racehorse legs, you know, like Colin Kaepernick has kind of racehorse legs.
Yes.
Now, what is there a next generation in terms of the playing surface that could change this? And, you know, you have the kind of composite turf now with the pebbles. Or you have, you know, most places natural grass in the National Football League. But is there something that can be done with the surface at this stage?
You know, the more I think about it, you know, the first is that a better surface is going to make, you know, unfortunately we've said faster surface equals better.
Yeah.
You know, we want speedy players. Speed is good on both sides of the ball. So if you want to slow the track down, you know, that's not where people are going. You don't want that. You want faster in both the shoes and the surface. One of the questions I've had is the hardness of it has gone up as it's gotten faster. The grass has gotten shorter. You turn it into essentially a putting green, and these guys can really run. That's why you see these getting ground up so much. Really, the solution, if you wanted to do this, would be to just play on mud. It would slow the players down. It would reduce the force that we'd have in collisions, and it'd be softer when they hit the ground inevitably. You see guys getting upended, landing flat on their back, or worse, when their head whips down into the ground, causing concussions. It's weird to think about, and I feel almost satirical when I say it, but playing in mud would really solve a lot of the problems of the NFL.
Which they certainly did for decades, and, you know, effectively, you know, large parts of the year, that's exactly what they played in. You know,
and well, they used to play in old baseball stadiums where you'd have, you know, the infield cutout would be a significant part of the field. And if you got rain or you got frost that thawed before a game, we can remember.
Or if the turf got torn up, they didn't replace it from week to week. You know,
right.
You always have a fresh field now. Yeah. There's, you know, you never have a worn field anymore.
Yeah. Well,
exactly.
Yeah. You had, well, you know, you had players who by the second quarter, you had a hard time identifying their numbers because they were so muddied up. On a slightly related, but maybe not totally related note, LeSean McCoy goes back into the game for the Eagles after he was hit and, for lack of a better term, saw stars. Should we be raising the concussion protocol flag again with this one?
I think we have to question it because, you know, the NFL has lost the benefit of the doubt on these. But the thing that I keep coming back to is that, you know, people say, I've never seen a guy come back once he's checked, once he's taken back to the locker room. And that tells me maybe we're not checking enough people. You know, there are times where you can get hit, and you can get hit hard, and you're not going to be concussed. We've seen in study after study that we don't really know what the concussion threshold is, that damage can be done by light hits that happen over and over, like what linemen get.
Right.
We can see car crash level hits where there's next to nothing. There was actually a study done here in Indiana by Purdue University using high school kids, and they were trying to calibrate the results, and they were seeing from these two kids before the game that they were getting 150G hits. And they were like, in pregame, how is this happening? Something screwed up. So they watched them the next time they warmed up. They because the sensors were marked to the jerseys, they were able to watch them very closely. And it turns out these two kids that weren't even playing significantly, they would start headbutting each other to fire themselves up before the game. And that's where they were seeing these kind of hits. They weren't concussed. Well, you know, maybe they were knocking themselves goofy, these little sophomores that weren't even playing. But you know, there are very hard hits that weren't causing any sort of noticeable symptoms. I would much rather have an NFL where they check players who have one of those noticeable hits where there's some question about it and have them come back than I would not check somebody and risk having them out there. You know, for a big player, you always have to wonder whether or not the team is putting pressure on the doctors, whether the doctor just feels that invisible pressure. There should be an independent doctor that should be completely away from that. But I don't take away that this is a bad thing that guys are checked and come back, because let's face it, they're being checked, and we have to at some level trust the doctors.
Boy, that would be a very different game to have somebody on the sideline, independent, who, you know, raised a flag and said that hit, you know, not, you know, the guy went back, he's back in the huddle, but I got to look at that guy. You know, that would happen.
Well,
how many times a game would that happen?
Since they have now. That's the thing, is they've got an independent observer who is supposed to be able to call down and ask the team to check. I have found no one inside the NFL that tells me that regularly happens. There's also an independent doctor on the sidelines, but he can only come over when asked.
Yes.
Or she, that is. There are a couple of situations where the neurologist is a female. They can only come over when asked by the team physician. So it's almost never done except to confirm their results. And the system on that level isn't working.
Yeah.
Well, and then you wind up with, you know, are we still right at, you know, any given Sunday, the movie? You know, is that really where we're at? Are we still there?
Yeah.
Have we advanced? And the McCoy situation, I mean, this is a guy, he took a hit to the head. He went down. He was lying on his back on the ground. He was clearly dazed at the very least. Whether he was not completely cold, I don't know. And the truth is, minutes later, he's on the sidelines complaining he wants to go back in. So somebody, you know, they looked at him and, you know.
You take away their helmet.
Well, that's what should happen, right? That's what's got to happen.
And that's what did happen. They did take McCoy's helmet.
Yeah, but you got to.
He was arguing with one of the athletic trainers saying, yeah, I'm ready to go back in. I feel fine. And you'll always get that. But you should never take the player's word. I give the trainer credit. He was basically saying no. And that's tough to do in the face of a star player or more often a coach who's saying, I need my quarterback. We see this a lot. Sadly, the high school level is where there's a lot of pressure about, I need that guy. We have to win this game.
Oh, yeah, we know.
You know, even the people with the best intentions will toss aside what they know to be right for the expediency of a win.
Will, good of you to take time for us. Thank you very much. We'll talk again, I hope.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys.
Will Carroll, the injury expert for the Bleacher Report. can follow him online. We'll take the break and come back with more. Primetime will continue on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Networks.
Like free sports tickets, trips, and memorabilia so you can trick your friends, colleagues, and mistresses into thinking that you're some sort of high roller? Hey, join the club.
Welcome to the club.
The Fan Club. Log on to Sportsnet590.ca. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
And the mirror's reflection, I'm a dancing with myself. And when there's no one else inside, I'm in the crowd and lonely night.
17 before the hour, McCowan here, Brent there. Thanks to Bob Ryan and Will Carroll for joining in this hour. What say you, Brent?
I'm just looking up at the TV there, so I just see the commissioner of the National Hockey League talking to George Strombolopoulos today at the Canadian Club. And I don't know. It would seem that, you know, the NHL at this point is kind of talking out of both sides of their mouth when it comes to expansion and the desirability of it. I know what Gary said today was they're quite happy with where they are. They get calls from cities all the time. Everything's hunky-dory, et cetera, et cetera. We know there's an arena in Quebec City. We know there's going to be an arena in Las Vegas. There might be there's going to be an arena of some sort in Seattle. Not quite sure if it's going to be a hockey rink or a basketball place or both. But I wonder where and Gary also said today, by the way, that there's no veto if you want to, that no one can veto a team coming into their market. It's purely a 75% vote, which I don't actually believe is true, but that's...
Well, we've heard that position before.
Yes, and there's a page from the NHL bylaws that I believe suggests otherwise. But anyway, when push comes to shove, what do you think they're actually going to do, Bob?
What, long term?
Well, let's say within the next 5 years. That's what we're talking about, realistically.
As we sit here today, and everything is subject to change, before they worry about expansion, they better worry about Florida and Phoenix.
Correct.
Because eventually those two franchises are going to have to be moved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, miracles can happen. Something can go on that could delay that process. But there just doesn't seem to be any way that those two franchises can continue to exist long term in those two markets.
And as I recall, there's a clean walk away in Phoenix. What was it, 4 years in after?
I think it's four. So you're going to have to address that. And no matter where you decide to put those franchises, they are going to take away from your expansion possibilities. So the good news that Gary has is one is an Eastern franchise and one is a Western franchise. And that's a tough one for him, because you could make the argument that Las Vegas is, I love Las Vegas and I've lived there and I think I understand the marketplace. I don't know whether I'd invest in a team in Las Vegas. Seattle, we've been talking about Seattle for 30 years, and there's still nothing. So I don't know whether Seattle's a realistic possibility. What we do know is everybody thinks a second team in Toronto, everybody thinks Quebec would be winners. Those are Eastern cities. Although the Toronto Maple Leafs played in the Western Conference for a number of years, and you could theoretically still do that, that's not the ideal scenario. So I think they got to... Maybe all Gary is doing is saying, we recognize we got a couple of issues we're going to have to deal with over the next year or two, probably. Let us get through that rather than go out and gobble up the only four expansion markets that possibilities that might exist, which right now I think would be Las Vegas, Seattle, Toronto, Quebec. Anybody else?
I can't think of one off the top of my head. No.
So there's four. If you're going to do four, there's the four you go to. What then happens if Florida throws the keys on the table? What then happens if Phoenix says, you know, we're still drawing 6,000 people. We can't make this go. We got to go someplace. Where do you go? Where are you going?
Now, but the other side of that is, though, Bob, if you're going to expand by two, let's say that's your game plan, right?
He said four.
Yeah, but you...
At one point.
But you kind of want four for your two, don't you? Don't you want people fighting? If you think of, you know, even way back when they did the big expansion in 66, 67. You know, they added six teams, but I think they had eight cities that were kind of in the mix.
Oh, well, they will always kind of...
No, but you want a bit of a fight,
well,
don't
sure
you?
Well, sure you do, because that raises the... That justifies or substantiates the expansion fee.
Because one of the issues they have apparently had in Las Vegas is that Jerry Bruckheimer, or whoever it's going to be, has been sitting back and saying, no, You know, no, you want $300 million for franchise? No, I'm not going to pay that.
Well, no, he Bettman asked for $350 and he asked for just under, I think, $190 million for Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, Philip Anschutz has that arena there that, you know, I guess, I don't know, is it a dinosaur already? It's 4 or 5 years old?
Well, the way things are going, probably. It's more than that, I think. But it probably is a dinosaur. But you do need to kind of create a marketplace, don't you?
For sale?
Yeah.
It's a real interesting question. I mean, I'm not sure you do. And I'll tell you why, because I think at the numbers that are out there now, I think Toronto and Quebec, for example, would pay, you know, the going rate. I don't think, you know, if you're in bidding against a Kansas City, is anybody going to pay for the same as much for Kansas City as they will for Toronto or Quebec? I don't think so. So I don't know how that influences the total dollars. I think it's a false economy. You know, there was a time when a franchise, I mean, they set the franchise fee. Remember with Ottawa and was it Tampa? Was $50 million?
Yes.
Were those the two places when Hamilton thought they were going to get it and it wound up going to Ottawa?
Yeah.
It was $50 million bucks, right?
Yes, that's right.
It was a set fee. I don't think it'll be a set fee again. I think it'll be based on market size. I think it has to be based on market size. I don't think Vegas, Jerry Bruckheimer's not going to pay $500 million for a franchise. But would somebody pay $500 million for a franchise in Toronto? I think they would.
Yeah, some of it so maybe framed as a territorial fee or something, right, that's going to go in someone's pocket other than the leagues.
Well, I don't know. All I'm saying to you is I don't think you have that. I don't think there's a set number that from now, you know, we're going to expand and here's what it costs you. We're going to give you, let's have 8 bidders for 2 teams and the price is this. I think the price is different for every market based on the sustainability of that marketplace and the ability to get somebody in that marketplace to look at it and say, I can make money at that number. You can't tell me that you or I or anybody else would pay the same thing for an NHL team in Kansas City as you would pay for a team in Toronto.
No, it's not. It's a different
totally
discussion,
different.
Obviously, yeah.
Totally different conversation. And I wouldn't pay as much in Kansas City as I would in Quebec. And I wouldn't pay as much in Kansas City even as I would in Seattle. And Las Vegas, I'm with Jerry Bruckheimer. There's a price point at which you'd roll the dice. And Bruckheimer's got some cake, but he's not a multi-billionaire. He can't afford to go into it and lose, you know, $20, $30 million a year. I don't or he's not willing to afford, I don't know. But
the other thing I wonder, Bob, and I said, you know, in terms of the timing, because you're right that they've got a couple of issues to settle, but you know, in some cases, the league is as stable as it's been in 30 years. They have labor peace guaranteed for a long haul. They have a big fat new long-term TV deal in Canada. Canadian dollar is at a place where they can live with it.
Yeah.
Right? It's not about to fall off a table.
Right.
So if you're selling high right now, aren't you? Things could get, you know, things could be worse is what I'm saying.
You mean if you're trying to expand, you can justify a big number.
I'm just saying right now, you can say, look at the next 10 years unfolding before us here. You got nothing to worry about. Which, you know, has Gary Bettman ever been able to say that during his tenure as commissioner?
Well, I'd still, you know, I mean, this is also a league that when it comes time to negotiate with its players, always parades out the woe is me.
Of course they do. Yeah.
You know, we have 3/4 of our franchises are losing money. And, you know, I can guarantee you when this collective bargaining agreement expires and the NHL goes back to the table, they will be singing that same refrain.
They all do that, right? The NFL did that, for God's sake. Yeah.
The minute the deal is signed, we're all in great shape. The league has never been healthier. 5 minutes before the contract ends, all of a sudden, Armageddon has hit. You didn't pay attention, but we've been looking at the numbers. We're losing so much money, we got to claw back from the players. So I'd like to look at what the real numbers are. I don't know how many franchises are making money. I don't know. And the ones that are losing, I don't know how badly they're bleeding. I don't really understand the compensation that's given by the other teams to try and prop them up. You know, I think there's a lot of mud where there should be clear water, and you can't see through mud. A lot of questions, not enough answers. But then again, according to the commissioner, we don't have to worry about it, at least not right now. But he's got a couple years left. I think he's going to pull the trigger before he goes.
Mm-hmm.
We got to get out of here. Brent won't be here again tomorrow, but I'll be here. Don't worry about it. See you then. Good night from Toronto.